Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. Some important and widely discussed legal issues on the local and national levels for our Legal Roundtable panel discussion this month. Proposition P passed in St. Louis, giving police and firefighters a pay raise as the courts and the Board of Aldermen move to more closely control the way police handle themselves at protest demonstrations. Then, of course, there has been an ongoing discussion about sexual abuse and harassment of women. Joining me to take on these and other issues are attorneys Bill Freivogel, who teaches journalism at SIU in Carbondale, Mark Smith, who's Associate Vice Chancellor and Dean for Career Services at Washington University, Michael John Voss is co-founder of the advocacy organization Arch City Defenders. Thank you all so much for being with us, and Michael John, thank you for your inaugural flight here at Legal Roundtable. Good to have you.
Good to be
us.
On board. Thanks.
Mark Smith, I'm going to start with you as a former member of the police board and a man who is very conversant with issues relating to the police department. Some irony in the fact that the Proposition P passed earlier this month, handily 60% of the vote, pay raise for police and firefighters. And then all of a sudden people start moving against the police department with regard to how they respond. Federal Judge Catherine Perry is imposing restrictions. We've got an ACLU suit against the police department for its response. And the St. Louis Board of Aldermen also moving. Tell me about it. What's going on?
Well, I think Judge Perry's case is the most interesting. She had a very detailed memorandum of findings, about 40 or 50 pages. And some of the things that she found was there was sufficient evidence to show that police were acting arbitrarily and in a retaliatory fashion towards protesters who were protesting the police. And so she put some limits on the use of chemical mace, that said that, you know, we have to give warnings beforehand. The Board of Aldermen bill is similar, suggesting some protocols that should be engaged in before police are able to do what they did before. And I think suggestion that they shouldn't be doing what they did before because it was arbitrary.
Yeah. Well, I guess everybody's lining up against the police department.
Yeah. I mean, I think that people are not happy with what happened, and it was I'm sure the folks here have other opinions as well, but the use of mace, you know, and it's interesting when you read through the documents, the police are saying, well, people came with goggles and backpacks and they viewed that as aggressive. But then the police come out in their riot gear. Everyone's prepared for the worst. And then the other side views that as aggression. I think both sides are just preparing for the worst. But it can't, you know, the police, what Perry has made clear is you have to give notice. You can't make people leave just because they don't like what they're saying.
It has to be an unlawful assembly.
And there has to be violence,
and
right?
Right. The statute and the ordinance as written requires that there be a conspiracy among people to commit an act of violence or violate the law with the threat of violence or force. And she's quite clear in her opinion that kettling, when that occurred, people were just hanging out. It was quite calm before the storm and was not an unlawful assembly. And yet the police still moved forward and executed that taking the streets back, you know, quote. And so it's the police, as Chief O'Toole said, owned the night. And that just kind of language strikes as though that the police are, you know, came out there with the mindset of arrest and detain. And that, you know, the night wore on, and the last warning was given over an hour and a half or so before the actual kettling occurred.
This is basically, we're talking primarily about that first demonstration, the 15th or 17th of September.
Well, both days.
Yeah, just for clarification, the kettling that you referred to is this idea of just kind of herding people together just as a group and moving them en masse someplace else.
Right, but in that instance, they didn't move them. They didn't give them orders. The order to disperse was unclear about where people should go, and they kettled, meaning they came on all sides and basically boxed people in and then used the chemical agents.
I think she said it wasn't completely clear whether the warnings, but there was definitely testimony that warnings had not been given. And I think she said also that there were the fact that you may have a few people doing illegal activities, you can't use that as an excuse to go against the whole crowd. So if there's 2% doing it, you can't disperse the whole crowd.
Bill, does this in any sense, do you think, handcuff the police? I mean, their charge is to protect lives and property. What do you think of that?
Well, I'm sure that there would be lawyers who would say that was the case. I mean, I think it is just requiring them to abide by the Constitution. I mean, it's very clear from what Judge Perry's memorandum that the St. Louis police had violated the protesters' rights in multiple ways in those first days of the demonstrations in September. Individual police officers were given the authority to use mace without giving any kind of warning, and not in self defense. The kettling we were talking about, closing off an area, not clearly giving a warning that it was an illegal assembly, not giving people a way to get out. Macing people because they were exercising their First Amendment right to videotape a police officer as long as they're not interfering with a police officer. I mean, these were gross violations. And it's not like there wasn't any kind of – it's not as if this was a first-time thing. I mean, there were – after the Michael Brown shooting back in 2014, there were a number of federal court orders that were issued, including against the St. Louis police – and a settlement in that case, saying that before police use tear gas or any chemical agent, they got to give some sort of warning, and there has to be the predicate for doing it. So it's not like they shouldn't have known. Mm-hmm.
Right. Michael, John, I wonder if this ends the matter, ends this discussion. I guess we won't know until there's another demonstration or reaction to it.
Well, I think it might it definitely provides clear guidance to the police, and I guess the police have I think there was a discussion just recently about the fact that they've issued a new set of orders that they're having the police review before they go out every month that talk about the rights of reporters and journalists, because there were journalists in that group that got tear gassed and or got maced and got locked up, who were there just to do their job. And I think that this ends it in terms of that, but actually these individuals, their rights were violated. So we're going to hear, most likely, many more cases filed against the city based on the actions of that night.
I mean, I think there's going to be the city and the plaintiffs in this case are going to have discussions to, what kind of final settlement to have or whether this case then goes to trial. It hasn't really gone to trial. There was testimony, but testimony was on the preliminary orders. And, I don't think it's going to end it until somebody figures out a way to make the police abide by the orders and abide by the Constitution. And I don't see that – it seems to me what happened September 15th and September 17th there shows that there was disregard for the First Amendment rights of the demonstrators.
Does the fact that it was a federal judge who issued this order, does that make any difference? Does it give it more weight perhaps?
The last one was a federal judge, Carol Jackson. So I don't know that it does. And what we were talking about before about it's welcome that O'Toole has said the police are going to be reminded every 30 days not to interfere with reporters who are covering demonstrations and the like. There was a Post-Dispatch reporter who was arrested in this kettling operation. But, the First Amendment rights of an individual citizen with a cell phone photographing or videotaping the police are really as great as they are of a reporter. Right. So, it'd be nice if they're reminded of that too.
Well, and just to interject, I mean, the police go through monthly training and tests on a lot of things from use of force, et cetera, but yet we still see violations. And so, right. Fundamentally, you look at the police department in the city of St. Louis, and just this last year, over 350,000 additional hours of overtime were worked. Millions of dollars were spent on the police beyond the budget, beyond what's there. And you just think maybe this is something deeper within the culture of the police department here and what we have.
It strikes me as somewhat odd that they're requiring now, or the Chief O'Toole is requiring monthly reminders to officers with regard to journalists, but there's no monthly reminder about how to handle protesters.
Yeah, that seems odd to me. Maybe there will be once this case is finally resolved.
But just to be clear, Judge Perry's order didn't forbid the use of chemical agents. It didn't forbid to say that this is an illegal gathering. But she She said what you guys have both said, that you can only do that in certain situations. You can't do it just because you don't like what they're saying. And, you know, the police department has a lot of very young officers. You know, turnover is pretty high. And I know one of the issues, you know, I was on a long, long time ago, a dozen years, but one of the issues was, well, we need more sergeants to kind of monitor the younger officers who don't always know how to handle a situation. You know, hopefully with Prop P, and I would like to think that some people who voted for it weren't saying, oh, we're in this, you know, binary choice, we're picking the police over the protesters. I suspect some people were saying, well, but if we can pay the officers better, we can maybe buy better training, we can keep officers on longer and have more seasoned, more respectful officers. But I know there's differences of opinion of that.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's throwing more money at an institution that already represents, you know, 33% of the budget for the city, and that's the policing part. If you add, you know, the cost of the incarceration in the courts, you're looking at 41% of the city's budget's going to policing and incarcerating. And it's just, I think it's a mindset, and we've talked about it. And I know Thomas Harvey, my co-founder and executive director at Arch City, talks about, you know, our budget is our value statement, right? And so we really, I think, need to talk about this within the larger context. And, you know, we personally, you know, in opposition to Prop P, the organization outlined its problems and some of the stuff that we did surrounding it and running up to the election, but you know, or the vote. But you know, I just think that we really need to look at it, the larger systemic issues with the police in the city.
I want to come back and talk more about Thomas Harvey and your organization, because it's been much in the news recently, and we'll do that in just a moment. This is our Legal Roundtable panel discussion day. With me in studio, you just heard from Michael John Voss of Arch City Defenders, co-founder of that organization. Also with me in studio is Bill Freivogel and Mark Smith, both attorneys, of course. We'll continue the conversation momentarily. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. And welcome back as we continue our Legal Roundtable panel discussion with Mark Smith, Bill Freivogel, and Michael John Voss. Before we continue with the Arch City Defenders as advertised a moment ago, we have a call from Tom in Afton who wants to talk about the protesters. So let's take that call, then we'll move on. Go ahead, Tom.
Thank you, Don. My question, when protesters get in the street in an unpermitted demonstration and block traffic, is that already illegal, or does the demonstration have to be declared illegal? See, I've been out there almost 20 times this year, and I always thought I was doing my civil disobedience just by getting out in the street.
Tom, thanks for the call. Who would like to take that?
Well, I think it's a good question. I believe Judge Perry says at the beginning of her memorandum that there was no permit, but the city didn't require there to be a permit, and city police officers had voluntarily closed off a number of streets in order for the protesters to be able to be in the streets as part of and march in the streets as part of their protest. So under those circumstances, there hasn't, you know, if protesters find streets that have been blocked off by the police to enable them to have protest and where no permit is required, then they're not violating any law by marching in the street. However, you know, if it's a street that is not blocked off where there's traffic trying to get through and protesters are blocking traffic, you know, like blocking Highway 64 or something like that, that is violating the law and it's not protected by the First Amendment. And, you know, police, I believe, would be required, particularly under Judge Perry's memorandum, to clearly declare it an illegal assembly. But then they could go ahead and arrest the people who continue to block the street.
Anyone want to add to that, or shall we just move on?
Well, she said they did not have a permit to protest because the city doesn't require one and it will not provide one. So I'm not sure, but you're right. They blocked off streets. When the bus was blocked, then, I mean, Perry is clear. She seems to make an exception from, who's the plaintiff, Ahmad, as that he wasn't doing always peaceful protests like the other plaintiffs in the case. Is that your understanding?
Yeah, I mean, I think just to address the caller's use of the word civil disobedience, civil disobedience doesn't mean that you're not breaking the law. I mean,
it
means actually that you are. You're just doing it in a civil, nonviolent, non-threatening way. And, you know, this is the purpose of blocking the streets and the intersection is to call attention and get basically the city to stop and wake up. And that's what people were doing.
Speaking of definitions, we have an email here, a minor quibble. Mark puts it this way. We keep talking about chemical mace. Mace hasn't been used, he says, for many, many years. Pepper spray is what all departments use now, so it's a little different product.
Well, I can tell you that the memorandum talks about mace.
Yeah.
And as a matter of fact, it talks extensively about mace. And the judge's problem with what the police did is that individual officers were authorized to use mace on their own authority and to declare illegal assemblies on their own authority. And the St. Louis Police Department said mace is not a chemical agent, so it's not covered by all of our rules about chemical agents. So the opinion and the injunction that the judge issued, the order the judge issued, specifically refers to mace used individually by police officers on demonstrators.
Okay. Thanks for that clarification. And, Mark, thank you for that email. I'll take one more call on this subject, then we'll move on. We have much to discuss. Kim is calling from St. Louis. Go ahead, Kim. You're on the air.
Hi. I keep hearing about how the police are going to be educated about how to handle these things and different types of situations. I think it would be a bigger effort, but also I think it might be more helpful if the public were educated more on how police are trained and what kinds of decisions they have to make and what kind of time frames. And I think a lot of people just don't understand from the policeman's perspectives.
Thank you, Kim.
Yeah, well, I think it's absolutely true that this is a really hard job for police officers. The judge said that herself in the opinion. And there's a lot of pressure on police officers, sometimes demonstrators begin throwing, water bottles or rocks at police officers. Of course, that's not at all protected protest. But, the judge in her opinion, used the Supreme Court legal standard, which is very deferential to police officers. It's a case called Connor, which says, you got to see it through the police officer's eyes and what would be reasonable for a police officer to do under the circumstances. So that's the standard, already very deferential to police that was used. Mm-hmm. But, I would totally agree with you. I mean, no protester should think that they can be blocking a police bus or throwing rocks or throwing bottles at a police officer and that being some sort of extension of their right of protest. It is not. It is a violation of the law.
Right, but the burden on following the Constitution falls on the officers, right? The burden should be placed on them in terms of what is the reasonable standard that they need to be held to. And frankly, it's a tough job being a police officer. I'm not going to question that. But it's also no one forces you to be a police officer. You've taken on that responsibility and that task. And if that's what you stand – if that's what you're going to do, then you need to follow the Constitution.
Well, this is just in. Rachel Littman of our news department tells us that the U.S. Department of Justice earlier today announced that it will investigate the St. Louis Metropolitan PD over the way it handled protests after the Stockley verdict. So this issue remains in the news.
Yeah, that's very interesting because those kind of Justice Department investigations are the kind that Attorney General Sessions had said he wasn't interested in. So that's quite an interesting development.
Somewhat telling, perhaps.
Yeah.
Okay. Another thing, we mentioned Prop P, but part of that Prop P money will go to the Circuit Attorney's Office. And I know we talked before about, Circuit Attorney Gardner wanting to have money to do police investigations and bring more of that in-house. And so this may allow her to do that.
To keep the police department from investigating itself essentially.
Right.
The Circuit Attorney's Office will get $1.3 million through Proposition
right.
P. She had asked for $1 million
right.
to fund this effort. Okay, Arch City Defenders. Michael John, your organization filed suit I guess this past week, with regard to conditions at the city jail. Tell us about that.
Sure. So this is a civil rights class action lawsuit that's been filed against the Workhouse, as it's called here in the city, which is a medium security institute. This is a place where most of the population, if like 90% of the population, are all pretrial. So it's individuals that have not been convicted of a crime. They're basically there because of their poverty, their inability to post a bond. A lot of the individuals in the jail there are facing minor charges, misdemeanor cases. These aren't the dangerous felons that the world is afraid of. Those individuals are at the Justice Center where there's individual cages that people are locked up in. In this situation, you have large rooms, somewhere upwards of 70 men in different pods where they have to share the space, and the space is deplorable. The conditions are such that there's one working toilet in one of these pods. If you have 70 men that need to use one toilet, can you imagine the sort of animosity that could come up because of that, the conditions of being in that space? There is no air conditioning in these units, no permanent air conditioning in these units. Over the summer, temperatures reached over 125 degrees inside these locations. So these people are being punished because of their poverty, because of the fact that they can't afford a bond to get out. And the city's known about this for years. This litigation is the third round go around here in it. Since the 70s, there's been litigation regarding the conditions of the jail and the Workhouse.
So you're seeking improved conditions or reducing the jail population or both?
I would love to shut down the Workhouse. This goes hand in hand with our issues, the issues we worked around regarding cash bail. We believe that there needs to be a better system in place to return people back to the communities that they come from when they're facing a charge, because truly that's what's going to support them in the long run and getting better services into those communities as well. So it's about issues of cash bail. It's about issues of the conditions of the workplace. Conditions of the Workhouse, and basically it's a violation of people's rights to keep people locked up in a cage because of their poverty, and that's what's happening here.
This whole issue of bail is something very close to your organization's heart. Now that Thomas Harvey, your co-founder of Arch City Defenders, is leaving, he's going to be working on the same sort of thing, but from California.
That's right. He's going to be one of the main organizers of the Bail Project, which is going to be based out of California, but it's going to have locations in 40 cities across the nation that are going to be they're going to house bail disruptors who are going to go and post bail for people. And it's going to be a massive undertaking in which there's going to be a lot of study going on in terms of the effects of getting people out and release and what that means to communities.
St. Louis is one of the first.
First three cities, St. Louis, right. Tulsa, and I think it was
Bronx.
York.
Yeah. Bronx.
Right, yeah.
And they're funded by $30 million, which is a lot of money, but the scope of this thing could probably chew through that relatively quickly, I would think.
Yeah, it could. You know, it's bittersweet to see Thomas go. He's still going to be a consultant for our organization, but I'm very happy with the new executive director coming in, Blake Strode, who's a St. Louis native, who was working with us for 2 years under a Skadden Fellowship, and he's been a great leader in the organization and moved up into this leadership role, and I'm really excited to work with him.
You know, I think the thing that this whole last several years and what Arch City has done has really taught me is that at the very lowest levels of the justice system, that there's all sorts of injustice that wrecks poor people's lives.
It's based on money.
Money. I mean, the process might look fair. You know, somebody doesn't show up in court, so there's a warrant for their arrest, so they're stopped, so they're put in the holdover. And then maybe there's another bench warrant, and they're transferred to another holdover. Meanwhile, their family doesn't have anybody earning money. They lose their house and their lives. Their lives are messed up.
Right. It's an issue of economics, obviously, but right. It also has a disproportionate impact on people of color. There are currently, as of September of 2017, 80% of the men in the Workhouse were African American. Mm-hmm. And so it disproportionately impacts people of color in our region, and that's a historic problem.
Because the Workhouse has been in the news, I mean, for 30 years. There have been lawsuits. And, you know, we built the Criminal Justice Center, when was that, like 2000, that took the pressure off the old facility there at 14th Street, I think.
Yeah.
But this new issue, which others have been aware of, but I never did criminal work. I was kind of immune to it. Mm-hmm. This idea that we're just putting people in jail, not because they're violent, not because we need to be protected, but because they don't have money, and so we're going to punish them that way.
Right.
It doesn't make a lot of sense.
It brings us to something else that I know your organization is involved in, and something I just heard for the first time last night, so-called wanted alerts, which apparently makes it easier for police officers to pick people up and put them away.
Right. Doing this work for over 8 years, I come across wanteds, and this is something that's different than a warrant, and people need to kind of know the distinction. So a warrant for someone's arrest is issued by a neutral party, a judge, basically, after the officers have found that they've got enough probable cause to take it to a judge to say, hey, this person needs to get arrested, and here's the crime we believe he committed. And it has to be specific to that person. This system circumvents that. The system is a way in which officers make arrests because another officer doesn't have the probable cause that they need to actually prosecute this case. And so we've heard instances where wanteds have been issued on witnesses who weren't compliant and talking. It was a way to put pressure on them. We have heard of instances where wanteds are issued on vehicles, just the vehicle number. People will be arrested who are driving that vehicle, even if it's not their car. Some of the stats that we've been we've been heard about this for a long time, and we brought the Center for Constitutional Rights on board as well as a law firm called Paul Weiss out of the East Coast, and we've filed litigation in 2016 challenging this system, and it's ongoing right now. And we've actually just recently last week we filed a motion of supplemental authority in the case because in the same court, in a different division, a judge found that there was evidence that needed to be suppressed because it came out of a wanted stop and arrest, not out of a valid arrest. And so we believe that there's clear case law in support of our challenge to that system. And again, it's an abusive system that basically, again, has no check with the judicial branch.
A constitutional violation,
yes.
You're saying.
It's an, yeah.
Who issues these wanted alerts now? Who?
Officers do. Any officer does, yeah. And right now there's over, I think at least some of the stats was 12 million wanteds issued in the state of Missouri. This is a statewide issue. It's not just St. Louis County Police who we sued on this. The city uses it as well as other departments. And, we're a population of 6 million people in the state of Missouri, and we got 12 million wanteds out there. What's going on here? So that's what the litigation is about and getting into.
Talk about making an end run around the system.
Sure,
that certainly sounds like it. Well, this brings us to something else. We have talked about this more times than I can count, and that is the issue with regard to the public defenders and the public defenders in Missouri being underfunded. A judge in Cole County has acknowledged this case overload that we've been talking about. Is any action likely now? I mean, a judge can't order more funding. It would have to be a legislative move, I guess. That's the only remedy for this situation, correct?
Yeah. The whole issue of whether judges can order states to fund some constitutionally required program, that's a very tough issue. It came up in the old days under the school desegregation cases. And actually, the court said in Kansas City that they could. But that's not how this is going to get resolved. I don't know how it's going to get resolved. I think maybe one of the best ways would be for judges to start appointing private attorneys and requiring them to represent people who are not now getting adequate representation. It's ridiculous to put all these huge caseloads on public defenders. And Missouri is very close to the bottom as far as resources provided to public defenders.
Second to least funding in the nation per capita. It's Mississippi and then us.
I think if my number is correct, that the average public defender in Missouri is carrying 219 cases.
I think
this judge said she was particularly concerned, this is drawing on what you said, with the people who are being held in custody who don't have a public defender to represent them, and that she may consider appointing attorneys to represent them specifically to move that move that along, this idea that people are being held for no reason.
This is all kind of coming together, isn't it? Everything we've talked about today is just kind of all part of the same story.
It is. I had an opportunity to – I was talking to a Washington University Law School class that Karen Tokar is there, a clinic class that she runs, and the students were talking about, for example, the conditions in housing court. I mean, we haven't even talked about – There's nothing in the news about housing court. But in housing court, the landlords win 99.5% of the cases. So this is another example of at the very lowest levels of the judicial system, things don't always work quite and the way this should.
Those are just the cases that are actually legally filed, right, in which
right.
the defendant, the tenant, is pro se and doesn't have counsel. How many illegal evictions go on in the city?
Right.
There's 18,000 that are issued every year in lawful evictions, quote-unquote. What about the ones that are unlawful?
And the frustrating thing to me is, I mean, when I started as a reporter 45 years ago, you know, in the early 1970s, my first stories were on the bail bond system and the abuses and how people were being detained and bail bondsmen were serving as sort of corrupt influence in the judicial system. And here we are all these years later, and you know, I don't know how much better it is. Maybe it's better, but these problems that we thought were solved years ago, they just persist and persist.
It's like lead paint issues.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The first stories I covered in St. Louis 45 years
right.
ago. Lead paint, we still have the problem. I'm going to have to take a break in a moment. We'll come back and talk about some of these sexual abuse cases that have been so much in the news. But before we do, we have more information from our partners at the St. Louis American who have been providing us information about this investigation of the police department. The U.S. Department of Justice's Civil Rights Division and the FBI's St. Louis Division have opened that investigation, which had been requested by Lacey Clay, congressman from the 1st Congressional District. So it is underway. We'll come back and continue the legal roundtable discussion in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. And welcome back as we continue our legal roundtable panel discussion with Mark Smith, Bill Freivogel, and Michael John Voss. Gentlemen, as you well know, you cannot turn on the radio, turn on the television, or open up a newspaper without hearing about Harvey Weinstein, Al Franken, or Roy Moore from Alabama and the charges made against these men, these sexual abuse charges. One question that comes to my mind, given the long periods of time that this story has covered, is there a statute of limitations on these kinds of crimes, do we know?
Yeah. And it varies from state to state. So, you know, you're talking about the criminal issues with these. So, you know, Al Franken's probably the things we've seen from him probably wouldn't rise.
It was in 2006.
Well, but it wouldn't rise to the level of a criminal violation, I don't think, unless there's something else I don't know about. But I think Weinstein is being investigated by New York and L.A. prosecutors for possible rape charges. With Roy Moore, you also have the issue of statutory rape, which is the idea in each state is different. There is you know, if you have consensual sexual relations with someone under the age of consent, it's still considered rape. So you have these statute of limitations. The other interesting thing is a lot of these cases have been settled, not in that, but with Weinstein, some of them. And so the settlements were secret. So non-disclosure, how does that affect the statute of limitations? Is it, you know, can you go back to bring a suit once you found out some of these are? This wouldn't be for the criminal stuff. But there's, you know, I think it's interesting. The law has a lot of ways to deal with the wrong. One is the criminal way, where society punishes the person. Then there are tort actions, so an individual could sue someone. We also have Title IX, which regulates the workplace and regulates like a school place that guarantees you a work environment free from sexual harassment. And obviously a sexual assault would be a severe enough one-time situation to create that hostile environment. And then you also have these issues like with Weinstein in particular and some of the folks at Fox who got in trouble. Did higher-ups know about this, retain these people, act negligently? Are the board of directors going to get sued? Are other people going to get sued because they kept this toxic person and they're continuing to create liabilities for the corporation? So, I mean, I think we're going to see a whole lot out of this for a long time.
And then there's the court of public opinion. That's the next.
Well, that's the other thing. Yeah.
And there's no statute of limitations in
the court of public
opinion. But in the Roy Moore, just to clarify one thing, in the Roy Moore case, I don't believe he is accused of statutory rape. But the actions he is accused of, you know, in relation to the 14-year-old would have been if they had been brought when it was still within statute of limitations, they would have been. They could have sent him to prison for 10 years. So I mean, they were that if the 14-year-old witness is the person who was 14 when the actions occurred, if she is telling the truth, and there's all sorts of corroboration that she is. That would have been a crime at the time.
I think molestation is the word that there is the word that they prefer to use in this particular case and in cases like that.
But I would just say overall, it's about time that we had this discussion. I mean, I don't think
I agree.
Some people say, you know, well, this is getting overblown, and I really don't think so. And you know, this has sort of gone in waves. You know, I think the first really big public discussion we had was Clarence Thomas and Anita Hill. That was a time when people said, sexual harassment? I mean, what are we talking about here? And it sort of awakened people to it. And, of course, then there was Bill Clinton and the charges of, you know, allegations of harassment and then what he did with Monica Lewinsky, which I guess was consensual, but where there was an enormous power differential. And then now, I mean, I think this is a kind of public discussion like we've never had before. And I wonder how much longer it will go on. I think it's really healthy.
You know, it's interesting that the only case that has been, quote, adjudicated is Bill Clinton, because he went through the whole impeachment process and, you know, he never left office. But in fact, he didn't through that.
He's the political one. But I mean, you know, we've got Bill Cosby, which is very much like this. And I think your comment about the court of public opinion is very telling, because Bill Cosby as a defendant, you know, first of all, he comes in as America's dad. He's viewed that way. He's much older, where Harvey Weinstein, I think, he's not going to be a sympathetic defendant like Cosby was made to appear.
I'm not sure Cosby was that sympathetic.
Well, but I think he was viewed – I think he was more sympathetic than Weinstein is what I'm saying. And I think also in Cosby's situation, I mean, this is a bad thing that helped him. He drugged these people, so they can't really talk about what happened as much. It was just a much tougher case than I think Weinstein's case, given some of the facts that we're seeing in the news. I mean – I think he should be very worried.
Yeah, I have no sympathy for any of them.
I don't either.
You know, so, yeah.
But, you know, it's an interesting part of the discussion that has involved just over the weekend, I think, is the fact that a lot of people are looking at Al Franken differently than they're looking at Roy Moore, for instance. And, you know, because while it wasn't really clearly the same thing, it wasn't dealing with minors. So, therefore, he should perhaps be treated somewhat differently than the others. What do you think? I mean, should there be some sort of standard reaction to this or legal reaction to it somehow?
I think just because we think all of this is bad, what Franken did was bad and what Moore's alleged to have done is bad, doesn't mean we can't make some sort of distinctions amongst the cases. So, you know, pedophilia, which is what Moore is accused of, that seems to me to be a whole different magnitude from what Al Franken did, as bad as what Al Franken.
I think the more interesting case is the Clinton. I think there are a lot of people who are revisiting their views of what should have happened to Bill Clinton. A lot of liberals who
I think that's true. But you know, as Don points out, I mean, it's not as if there wasn't an impeachment and a trial.
Well,
of course, that only related to Monica, the actions relating to Monica Lewinsky, but there were also, you know, court proceedings relating to Paula Jones. So, and there's, you know, question of
Jennifer Flowers.
Right. So, I think that Bill Clinton's, what happened with Bill Clinton is sort of relevant, just like maybe what Clarence Thomas did. Or is alleged to have done by Anita
I do
Hill
think. I mean,
relevant.
It's unfortunate we have four men here talking about it. But right. I mean, all the women I know have said, you know, yeah,
exactly.
This happens all the time, and you can almost pick out the guys who are going to do it, and you can pick out the guys who are not going to do it, and you know that there are nice men who just, and then there are these predators who are just,
Right. I mean, it's kind of
tolerated.
It's similar to kind of the question that was asked once of my co-founder Thomas Harvey when he was asked, why are people now just awakening to the problems of the municipal court? And he said, well, it depends on what you mean by people, because yeah. other people who haven't had a voice and haven't had the bully pulpit and haven't been given sort of the leniency of doubt they've known it for years, sure. for decades. I mean, this is modern American culture, and women have experienced this. There isn't a woman I know
right.
who hasn't experienced this from
right.
my wife down. So, like, I just the fact that we are now talking about it on a national level, hopefully will bring about change. But you know, it needs to be sustained, and there needs to be
repercussions.
Yes,
so people don't think they can get away with it.
And the name we have left out is Donald Trump. I mean, what about what Donald Trump is accused to have done and have bragged about doing, you know, which is sexual assault.
Right.
So let's not leave him out of the conversation.
Well, you know, that brings us back once again to the different standards for different people, mm-hmm. depending on what your reaction to them is. There was another point I wanted to make, and I've forgotten what it was. Anyway, it'll come to me probably at the wrong time. Anything else we want to say about?
Well, the other thing that's kind of, you know, as someone coming from education, you know, that the Trump administration education department has pulled back all the two Dear Colleague letters that came out during the Obama administration about how to enforce Title IX, and they haven't. DeVos hasn't said what she's going to do yet, but I doubt it's going to be. More strict standards. And so I think, you know, a lot of universities, and I think we have said, we're going to continue to follow the old Dear Colleague and their Q&A sheet they released. But it's going to be – I do think there's going to be a resurgence of this.
I do think that there's a responsibility for men who do not do this sort of thing to not just like laugh at some, you know, at a Donald Trump kind of right. locker room, statement, or to, you know, ever look the other way. It's really important for men to stand up and make sure they stand up to this kind of action by other men.
I remember now what it was I wanted to ask. It's been mentioned here. Some people are saying that we should revisit the Bill Clinton situation. How? I mean, what do we do?
Well, I don't know if this is what I was saying, but I'm not saying revisit it. I'm just saying a lot of people, and I would include myself in this group, you know, when that happened with Bill Clinton, it was like, well, it seems kind of trumped up, and I don't know what happened. And then you found out, but it was like, well – I think I would be harsher.
Well, I thought at the time. I mean, I was writing editorials for the Post-Dispatch on this at the time, and what we said was this was terrible. Lying about it to the grand jury was terrible, but it was not an impeachable offense. And I still think that actually.
Do you think you should have stayed on as president?
Well, since I don't think it was an impeachable offense, yes. I mean, I think if he had resigned, fine. You know, that I wouldn't have had any problem with that. But I didn't think he should be removed for it.
Okay, enough of that. Let's move on. Time is getting away from us. Question as to whether or not Governor Greitens broke the law in removing a school official. Right. Post-Dispatch raised the issue after House Minority Leader Gail McCann Beatty, a Democrat, said the Republican governor violated state statute when he removed a State Board of Education member, Melissa Gellner, from office. State says once a board member takes office, the governor cannot remove without cause and due process. He says he has the authority. She had not been confirmed by the Senate. Any thoughts on that today? Who's right?
Well, it seems as though that story refers to an Ashcroft opinion that seems to say once they've taken the oath and taken office, that then the governor can't just like pull her back
without some due process.
Without some due process, you know, say there's something that the person has done wrong,
and she gets a hearing about it.
And she gets a hearing. I mean, what the governor is doing here to try to get rid of the education commissioner and appoint a, you know, pro-choice school choice person in who I guess is already lined up in her place. I just think it's the worst of sort of political, you know, trying to turn a body like a State Board of Education into a just like a political tool.
Stacking the deck is basically
– I think that where the lawyers might quibble about is whether or not she took office, because it was a recess appointment. So did she take an oath? Or did she – you know, did they meet as a group? I don't think they've met yet. So I think there'll be enough for the lawyers on both sides to argue about it.
Okay. Well, school choice, as you've indicated, Bill, seems to be behind all of this.
Yeah,
there doesn't seem to be much of a question about that.
It's a political agenda.
Another issue here concerns our Missouri Attorney General, Josh Hawley. He's taking on an interesting Goliath, I think, because he's going after Google. Michael John, are you familiar with this case and what he's trying to do?
I see. You know, he's trying to figure out what records Google's keeping, what documents they're retaining or information they're retaining on people who use the services and how they use that to kind of either craft results in terms of search results, et cetera. And I find it interesting that it's a solo action of the AG's office for the state of Missouri. I mean, most of the time when you see these large cases, and there was one back in 2013 against Google, it was multiple states. And it definitely had states with larger resources than Missouri does in its AG's office. And so you had New York and California and other states that filed that action. And again, it was looking at consumer protection issues just like this one is. And again, you know, I think if we put it in the context of the fact that he's a rising star within the Republican Party here, and what's this about, really, fundamentally, what's it about, and what information caused that dear Google letter to go out, I'm not sure. So, no.
Well, he has issued a subpoena, from what I understand.
Yeah, investigative subpoena and to determine whether or not Google is violating the Missouri Merchandising
Practices Act.
You know, I'll be a little surprised if he makes a lot of traction here. You know, he cites as some background. Well, he had taken on, as I think did his predecessor, he had taken on Backpage. But you know, there was a real connection between Backpage and some, you know, really nasty, sexual,
trafficking.
Yes, thank you. And which I don't think really exists here. And it's also interesting that he's citing a couple of European Union decisions on antitrust and all. And you know, our laws are different. The European Union decisions have absolutely no effect here. So that's sort of a strange kind of precedent to be set.
To my knowledge, Google has not responded to the subpoena. And Hawley has indicated that he might sue, possibly, which if he did that would take him nicely through 2018, I'm sure, and perhaps a political campaign against Claire McCaskill during that.
Yeah, I think it would be it's popular for the little state of Missouri to take on and the brave attorney general. These are air quotes to be taking on the big Goliath of Google. But you know, are we a lot of us surprised that Google has got a lot of information about us, and that including what we buy on our credit cards, and that they use that to make more money? That's what they're all about. That's their business plan.
Yeah, right. You know, it's really scary. I purchased something online late last week, and every time I've gone online since to go to newspapers or any place else, these products keep popping up in front of me. I just, you know, it is really scary how much and how quickly, and the same thing happens to all of us, I'm sure, how quickly they can make this thing happen, how quickly they know what you're thinking and what you're interested in.
Yeah, my wife bought a vitamin at Walgreens, and she opens up her browser for a Washington Post story, and there's a Walgreens ad for that very vitamin that she had bought. Now, I don't know how Google and Walgreens and the vitamin divide up that economic pie, but it's really weird to see that happen. It's just going to happen more and more.
I mean, you've hit it on. It's capitalism. I mean, this is just what a free market, how it works. And this is what we're in right now, especially with these large companies that have all this information and they have free reign under the law to mine it. What I'm scared about is who gets shared with, right, and who has access to it. And especially if you think about the fact that the federal government is a buyer out there and for this information, it does scare me, and I think we need to have those restrictions.
We only have 30 seconds left, but in a way it's sort of a confirmation of what the Russians, for instance, can do with computers in terms of manipulating public opinion. It lends more credence to that, don't you think?
Yeah. Yes,
we bought some Facebook ads. And it's amazing how you can micro-focus them. I want WashU students who are doing this.
Yeah. you can boost any message that you want to get out there by just give a little bit of extra money to Facebook. And
as we've said many times in this program, there's a lot of law yet to be written about concerning the internet. Well, gentlemen, thanks so much. Our time is up. Interesting discussion today, and certainly covered a lot of different kinds of bases today. Michael John, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Good luck with you as the reconfigured Arch City Defenders begins to evolve.
Yeah.
Thank you for being
thank
with
you.
Us. Bill Freivogel, great to see you. And Mark Smith, nice to see you again. We'll do it again in about a month. Have a great holiday, all of you. Archive versions of past St. Louis On the Air programs available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org/stlonair. It's a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thanks for listening. I'm Don Marsh.